Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, 1 year after the Merrimack Valley gas explosions, one businessman tells us,
every option when Columbia Gas was given an option to do the right thing, they took the sleazy way out. And just going by past actions, I think they're doing the same thing still.
We'll hear from those still affected and speak with Congresswoman Lori Trahan. And
yes, we will raise the minimum wage to a living wage.
Those at the very top, the richest individuals and the biggest corporations, are going to pay more. And middle class families are going to pay less.
I'm going to go like the rest of them do, twice over, okay?
And we'll get reactions and analysis to last night's Democratic presidential primary debate, including your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
It's been a year. It's been a crazy year. Se ha sido un año loco, un año rápido, pero un año loco.
That's Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera, speaking about the year since gas lines pressurized 12 times higher than what they should have been, exploded in the Merrimack Valley. The explosions caused dozens of fires in Lawrence, Andover, and North Andover, damaging or destroying more than 130 buildings and driving thousands of people to evacuate. 18-year-old Leonel Rondon, sitting in a car in a friend's driveway, was hit by a falling chimney and died. He had just gotten his driver's license. Today in Lawrence, officials and members of the community gathered to dedicate a public square in his memory. Mayor Rivera was among them.
This is what we have to do because we want to make sure that people don't ever forget that through all this stuff that happened, that a life was lost, a beautiful life was lost. And we hope when they come by Leonel's sign, they're going to say, I remember that kid.
And Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey said Rondon's death would not be for nothing.
To the family of Leonel, we express our greatest sympathy. But know that in his name, in your family's name, there will be hundreds, thousands of lives which are saved in the future.
Also at the event this morning was Congresswoman Lori Trahan. She represents the Merrimack Valley, and she joins us on the line now. Congresswoman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Congresswoman Trahan, you spoke at the event this morning in honor of Leonel Rondon. What were your impressions of the event?
You know, it was a beautiful tribute to Leonel Rondon. I know a lot of times, because of the accountability measures, we talk a lot about Columbia Gas or the buildings, the road repairs. But I remind people all the time that a young man's life was lost. And probably one of the most impressionable moments right after I got elected was hearing from Lucy Rondon, Leonel's sister, who said at a large public hearing, a field hearing of the Senate Energy and Commerce Committee in the city of Lawrence. And she said, we will not let this loss be without meaning. And that set into motion a partnership that, you know, extended far beyond Lawrence's borders. The mayor has been extraordinary in terms of leading the resilience of this community. The state reps and state senators and the governor's office, the secretaries. And, you know, my partnership began with Senators Markey and Warren and with Congressman Moulton in introducing the Leonel Rondon Pipeline Safety Act so that we ensure this never happens to another community again.
Congresswoman, I'd like to talk about safety and I'd like to talk about Columbia Gas. The Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities wrote a letter yesterday saying that Columbia Gas didn't follow protocol when abandoning service pipes after the explosions last year. Columbia is agreeing to inspect more than 700 abandoned gas lines. Given the company's history, does that concern you?
Absolutely. You know, my understanding is that there's no threat to public safety, which I want people to know. But, you know, the people who are living in Lawrence and Andover and North Andover, they're still raw. They're still fearful. And on the 1 year anniversary, you know, it's this is tough news to hear. And the company needs to work on rebuilding trust with its customers and with all of us. You know, clearly, our role in government is to, you know, oversee and enforce the laws and the regulations, and we're going to continue to hold Columbia Gas accountable until all of these pipes are, you know, inspected and you know, this project is concluded.
Congresswoman, yesterday we actually spoke with Columbia Gas President Mark Kempick as the news was emerging that they were going to inspect these abandoned lines. Here, he said it was a proactive measure. Here he is.
So what we want to do is to look to make sure that on those abandoned services, we've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's on the Massachusetts compliance regulations.
Does that answer satisfy you? Because the state's actually alleging that the company violated federal and state pipeline law when they sealed the lines in the first place.
Yeah, I think what we have to ensure, and I appreciate the DPU for stepping in and requiring extra inspections and leak surveillance, because that is a way for the Commonwealth to instill trust. You know, if it's not done right, you know, my understanding is this is another $1 million fine for Columbia Gas. But more importantly, psychologically, the company has to be proactive in easing fears and concerns with its customers. And, you know, clearly this is not a company that should be making errors or mistakes, whether it's in communication with its customers or missing a deadline. And so, you know, I think the state and local officials, along with, you know, my partners in the federal government, we are all on this, whether it's, you know, making sure that the company's held accountable, making sure that the claims are being paid in proper timing to the small businesses and to the families who are still waiting, and ensuring that we have good legislation and good regulations on the books so that this never has to happen again and people don't live in fear of what's underground.
So given that people may be in fear, do you trust Columbia Gas to be doing what's necessary to avoid another disaster?
Yeah, right now I think that there is a spotlight on the city of on the company, on Columbia Gas. In its aftermath, you know, an unbelievable job was done in a very short amount of time. And it was because there was a coalition of companies, other utility companies helping, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and all of that bringing to bear. And so, you know, this company is being, it's being watched, right? I mean, I think that the mayor is on the ground. He is fielding those calls from people, watching the bills come in, making sure that the rates aren't being hiked unnecessarily. And we are in close communication on all of this because, you know, our work is not done until we've closed the last case, until we've paved the last road.
So speaking of finishing the work, in July, Columbia Gas settled a class action lawsuit for $143 million, which is awaiting approval in the next several weeks. Before that, the company reached an $80 million settlement with the governments of the three communities. These $2 amounts, these settlements, do you think they cover the full damages of the disaster?
You know, in total, the cost to, you know, Columbia Gas has exceeded $1.5 billion. But I want to be super clear. You know, when we're talking about a young man's life, when we're talking about lost business because people aren't frequenting, you know, the local bodega the way they used to, when we're talking about the hidden wounds of people who are still traumatized, there is no dollar amount that we can talk about. So I think that what I've seen on display and what was absolutely reflected in the anniversary event that I went to today was a resilience in a community. You only get that when people come together. And Lawrence has all of that. Like I said, there's a partnership that goes well beyond the borders of this city. They know that their Washington legislators have their back and are working hard to transform our laws, but they also feel that every day with the leadership provided by their state and local representatives. And, you know, I will say one thing. I know we tend to do this on a one-year anniversary. You know, we talk about the company. We talk about Columbia Gas. Today's not about Columbia Gas. Today is about Leonel Rondon. It's about his family. There was a beautiful mass that was, that we all attended today, the governor, the mayor, the entire state delegation. And we're reminded of who he was. We're reminded of the lives that he touched. His friends were there mourning, you know, their friend. And we were also reminded of what Lucy, his sister, told us to do and make sure his life never is forgotten and that this loss is never without meaning. And you see that all over the city. You see that at the school that he went to. There's an art recovery room. You see that in the square that we dedicated for him today, the start of the Spigot Greenway. And you're going to see his name on major landmark legislation, the Leonel Rondon Pipeline Safety Act, ensuring that that legislation saves lives and no other family has to go through this again.
Congresswoman, what is the status of that legislation?
Thank you for asking. So it's passed the House and we are, it's passed markup in both chambers. And so we are, that bill is ready to either be a part of an infrastructure bill, a broader infrastructure bill, but it's also ready to move on its own. There's bipartisan support for this bill. So we are looking to pass that legislation before the end of the year. You know, Senator Markey called me a couple of weeks ago to alert me that it passed a major milestone in the Senate, which not a lot of legislation has passed milestones in the Senate, but this one did. It went through his committee and markup. So we're going to be moving it and accelerating it the best we can.
So, Congresswoman, you said earlier, you were pointing out that there is no amount of money, it's not the only thing and it's not at the heart of this. So a year later, you've spent time in the community today. You've heard from your constituents over the last 12 months. What else will it take to help make people, businesses, and these communities whole or healed again?
Well, thank you for asking me that question because, you know, one thing that we've really focused on, and there's a coalition of nonprofit groups that is really focused on rocking the register. You see it on Twitter. It's a hashtag, rock the register. But whether we're talking about North Andover, or Lawrence, you know, there is a concerted effort to bring neighbors, community members, friends and family back to those small businesses that, are not back to 100% their normal business revenues. And so, you know, I think what I'd like to tell people who are listening on the radio or reading the newspapers, if you have an opportunity to visit one of these affected communities and support a small business there, either going to a bodega and ordering some fried chicken like at Jacqueline's, or if you could go to a gift shop or a hair salon, do it because the community needs it. And that's actually what's going to bring back and make those communities flourish again.
Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's turn to another voice. Joining us now from Leonel Rondon Square in Lawrence is WBUR reporter Callum Borchers. Callum, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi, Callum. You've been listening in and you were at the event this morning. How would you describe the mood in Lawrence today?
Boy, it was really heavy, Tiziana. I mean, Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera led things off, and he made the point that these kinds of dedications are often for fallen soldiers. You know, those are tragic in their own way, which is certainly something he understands. He's a veteran himself. But there's also that bit of comfort that comes from knowing someone has died for the noble cause of serving the country. And Rivera made the point today that in Rondon's case, it feels like just a senseless tragedy. And so I think that feeling really weighed on everybody this morning.
Hmm. Much of the ceremony this morning was dedicated to Leonel Rondon, the young man who was killed. Did anyone from his family speak, Callum?
Well, Rondon's parents and siblings participated in the unveiling of a new sign that marks the square, but nobody actually spoke during the ceremony itself. Afterward, however, Rondon's sister, Luciani, did speak briefly with reporters, Tiziana. You might remember that she spoke very powerfully at that Senate hearing in Lawrence last fall, where the senators were grilling Columbia Gas officials. She's really showed remarkable poise throughout the past year, and so here's some of what she said this morning.
We are very appreciated with the community, and that's something that we wanted to let the community know, that it's not only our pain, but it's the community's as well. So we wanted to share this moment with them as well.
Callum,
and she added, Tiziana, that when people see the sign for the new Rondon Square, she hopes that they'll remember that this Columbia Gas disaster never should have happened in the first place.
So let's talk about Columbia Gas. You heard me ask the congresswoman, you know, the State Department of Public Utilities yesterday said it's going to investigate whether Columbia Gas violated the law when it abandoned the gas lines. It says it's going to expect more than 700 service lines it abandoned. Was there any reaction from the public officials to this news coming today?
Yeah, you know, they didn't bring it up during the ceremony. I think they wanted to keep the focus on honoring Leonel Rondon. But Mayor Rivera and Governor Charlie Baker did both vent their latest frustration when speaking with reporters afterward. Rivera said he knew, or Columbia rather, knew more than a month ago that workers had failed to cap some of the old lines that were taken out of service, but didn't notify regulators right away. And so here's what he had to say about that delay.
These guys get paid way too much money to jerk around with information they have about people's safety. It's unacceptable. I don't know why they did it, but the reality is that they did it. Now we're here, and we have the winter up against our back.
So Rivera's calling for the Department of Public Utilities to fine Columbia Gas some $33 million. That's $1 million for every day the company didn't disclose. Governor Baker didn't go that far, Tiziana. He's very measured, as we know. But by Charlie Baker's standards, he was pretty irritated. Now let's take a listen.
I'm annoyed that they apparently knew about this for a while and didn't just tell us, because the second they told the DPU and the DPU told us, we turned around and told the communities.
So that's an annoyed Charlie Baker. As for the fine, though, he says he wants to wait for the DPU investigation to play out.
So, Callum, one of the things that's been on our minds is how safe people do or don't feel a year after the explosions. I understand you witnessed something kind of telling today about how much the fear from the explosions is still with people.
Yeah, I mean, some of those signs are still there. So there's the physical signs. I mean, Baker, for one thing, commented on the scarring, as he put it, that you can still see on the roads. Remember, Columbia agreed to pay that $80 million settlement to Lawrence Andover and North Andover so they can repair the roads, but all that work hasn't been done. But the episode that jumps to mind, I think you're referring to, Tiziana, is we were in the middle, reporters and all gathered around Mayor Dan Rivera asking him some questions. And all of a sudden, everybody catches a whiff of natural gas. And the mayor just looks exasperated as this happens. So he pauses the gaggle. He turns to an aide and says, can you please go check with the fire chief, who was on the scene anyway for the ceremony? And then the aide returned a short time later and reported that the chief believed the odor was just emanating from a nearby sewer and that there was no danger. But people are on edge, as you could imagine. I mean, anytime people smell gas up here, they're worried, and you can understand why.
Yeah, I can. Callum, any last reflections from what you've seen today?
Well, you know, this was certainly not an overtly political event, but there is often that subtext at events like this. And I think we saw a little bit of that today. You know, Senator Markey was here, as Lori Trahan mentioned a moment ago. And I will note that he was just showered with credit from Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera and appreciation from the community for bringing that Senate hearing to Lawrence, the one where Luciani Rondon spoke so powerfully almost a year ago now. And so I thought that was notable, you know, as he faces the potential strong primary challenge from Joe Kennedy. I think that it's notable that he has apparently a strong supporter up here in Mayor Dan Rivera.
Callum Borchers, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
We also spoke to two Lawrence business owners. Elizabeth Bautista is the owner of Delish Bakery and Cafe. She told us the cafe had been her dream, and she'd worked hard as a waitress to save money for it.
I was a waitress before doing my business, and I worked 7 days a week for save money. And then something broke in 3 months. I'm broken. I need to do something. I need to do something for my business.
And then there's John Farrington, who owns Carlene's Coffee Shop in Lawrence. His shop was damaged from the explosions, but the day after, he was there to serve coffee to the community. He said everyone was in disbelief.
Unfortunately, the aunt of the young boy who died
just got his license and a chimney and fell on him. Mm. His aunt was there, and she looked stunned and just like she was in shock still. And a lot of other people had that same sort of fear and just look on their face. And every time a truck went by, a fire truck or something like that, you get that diesel smell.
Yeah.
And people would think it's natural gas. They had that look of terror on their face. And that lasted for months afterwards.
Is it done now, or are you still and other people still afraid sometimes now?
Oh, no. I have a lot of customers all throughout the neighborhood in Andover, North Andover. But the ones local, they still have the fear of the stove. Some didn't want to cook for months afterwards. And some, if they get a smell of, usually gasoline or diesel from outside the roadway or something like that in the restaurant, they ask you right away, is that gas? Check your gas. So that still happens.
How long until you reopened?
I opened up January 15th.
Wow.
I was shut down 4 months.
That's a full...
And for a restaurant to be shut down 4 months is a death warrant. People, and especially in the diner, they're into regular habits. You see the same people, four times a month, either, twice a week or every day. And you get them that much out of their habit, they form new habits, either eating at home, taking a walk, or doing something different, or go to a different restaurant. We just lost a huge amount of our business.
So your customers haven't really come back.
Well, they a lot of times they don't want to go through the aggravation of coming back. I mean, it literally was to go a mile around here was sometimes a half hour.
How much has this cost you, John?
Oh God, I know I probably put $30,000-$35,000 out of my own pocket back into the business. Never mind that, just to cover media bills. Never mind the debt I've built up in the restaurant. So, by not paying certain bills and this and that, or extending my credit, or outright not paying the state points, I owe them money. So I'm in the hole probably, $60,000-$70,000.
Do you think anyone will ever make you whole?
I don't think they want to. They don't want to try. I have one gentleman I speak to from Louisiana, nice guy, but he's sort of the gatekeeper or of all the other people that he refers to that can't do anything. And it's frustrating. And that's the insurance company of the gas company. And you talk to the gas company and they really, you can't really talk to the gas company. There's no one to speak to from the gas company. And they don't come by and see if you're okay. So I'm to the point where I'm just going to hire a lawyer to try to figure out the rest of it, which is going to cost me more money.
John, you may know that Columbia is looking to settle a class action lawsuit with residents and business owners.
Mm-hmm.
The settlement, which still has to be reviewed by a judge, was for $143 million. Are you a part of that settlement? Do you know?
I don't know, honestly. I don't know if I'm on a list, if I have to sign up for this, if I've missed my window. Because I took Columbia Gas's word at first, saying, we'll make you whole, we'll get you guys out of this.
Would you take their word now?
No. My first and biggest fear was getting my customers back, and I mentioned to them. And like, yeah, don't worry, we'll take care of it. And no. I've seen more money spent by them saying how they've taken care of everything than I've seen action on the ground.
What else would you like to see from them, John?
A sincere, just effort, just apology, not one just covering their butt. They truly affected a nice old neighborhood in Lawrence. South Lawrence West was always a very close, nice neighborhood where a lot of people knew each other and everything else. And they literally traumatized an entire neighborhood because they wanted to save money on engineering. Not getting enough people to look to figure out they didn't put the pressure valves on, So I just want them to, make an effort. My employees were shorted on their right before Christmas. They were told that they're not going to get paid anymore, that they had somehow stolen from the system and didn't represent themselves properly, and they're going to come after them and chase money.
So I want to go back and understand this. Your employees filed claims, individual claims, with Columbia Gas. Is that right?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. They want to let me file on their behalf and pay them.
They must have been terrified.
They're honestly terrified.
Did they ever provide financial relief to your employees?
No, they left them. They all didn't get roughly 5 weeks of pay after that. So, I mean, all of them trying to make their monthly rent and everything else, and that's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, when they said they would take care of all the employees, they immediately sent a bunch of headhunters over trying to get them all new jobs, which would have left me with absolutely no staff. So every option, when Columbia Gas was given an option to do the right thing, they took the sleazy way out. And just going by past actions, I think they're doing the same thing still.
That was John Farrington, owner of Carlene's Coffee Shop in Lawrence. And we reached out to Columbia Gas about his claims about the headhunters, and we have not heard back. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll get reactions to last night's Democratic presidential primary debate, including your calls. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. From 20 to 10, a winnowed Democratic debate stage last night in Houston.
Imagine what would be possible right now with ideas that are bold enough to meet the challenges of our time, but big enough as well that they could unify the American people.
We have got to recognize that this country is moving into an oligarchic form of society.
I've actually never met anybody who likes their health insurance company.
There's enormous, enormous opportunities once we get rid of Donald Trump.
We have a white supremacist in the White House, and he poses a mortal threat to people of color all across this country.
It's not a referendum on Donald Trump. It's a referendum on us and who we are and who we're going to be together.
And now, President Trump, you can go back to watching Fox News.
Woo! So what were the biggest headlines from last night, and did anybody shake up their standings in the still crowded field? For more, we welcome in Susan Tracy, a Democratic strategist and president of The Strategy Group. Susan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We also have in Studio 3 Michael Curry. He's the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
And you. We want to hear from them, but we also want to hear from you. What did you make of last night's debate? Have you decided who you'll be voting for in 2020? What's the most important issue to you in 2020? And is it getting the attention it deserves? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Susan and Michael, let's start with you. What were your reactions from last night? Susan, go ahead.
You know, my reaction, kind of top level, I don't think the field changed last night. I think, you know, the kind of the front runners are the front runners. I think we all learned a little bit more about the rest of the field because it was a smaller group. And I feel like Mike's sort of bigger, maybe this is my Democratic, perspective on it, was it was really amazing to look at that stage and see a field of candidates that looked like the United States. You know, it was diverse. There were women, there were minorities, there was a gay member, there was a veteran. And, that's the first time I've seen that kind of a field. So I felt pretty proud of that.
There was a huge age range, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Michael, how about you? What were your reactions?
You know, it's it's interesting. I don't watch a lot of professional baseball until the playoffs. And I don't watch a lot of professional football. Well, that's not true. Football I watch. I felt like we were at the playoffs now.
Interesting.
The better candidates were there. And you're looking for clarity, passion, some understanding of the issues. And I felt like we were finally at that point. We're the best candidates. We're now debating the issues.
All right. So were there any winners or losers last night? Susan, sorry. I'm supposed to traffic cop and I didn't. I just got all excited about the script. Susan, any winners last night?
You know, I think you'd have to say that Biden was a winner and Warren were winners because they probably stay at their perch, right? They probably stay where they are. I think the big loser last night had to be Castro.
Interesting.
You know, yeah, I feel like that kind of ageist slap, you know, that wasn't an issues slap. That was an ageist slap at Biden, and I think that hurt him a lot.
Let's play that cut, actually. It was during the healthcare discussion, but it was not about healthcare.
You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
To buy in, if she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
Michael, I was struck by that. What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, I wasn't as offended by it. I think ultimately they're going to get much worse from Trump. So it's a good preparation for that debate. Castro was calling into question his memory of the things he said, the contradictions. I didn't think that was offensive. I thought Castro did very well. Winners for me were Warren and Biden. I thought the two of them were the strongest of the candidates. Kamala Harris wasn't as strong as she normally is. Cory Booker was much better than I've seen in any other debate.
And any losers from your perspective?
I think, you know, those that are falling towards the end of the polls are the ones that were not as strong in the debate. And I think it's, you know, people are jockeying for time. Castro, I thought, was okay. He could have been stronger. And I've been a kind of rooting for him to be stronger. O'Rourke is always a win for me because he hits the issues of race. He is deep on the issue of gun control and what he experienced in El Paso. Credit to him for that. I don't find much there beyond that. And I struggle with him as well. I don't know if there's any losers. I just think there's standouts.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join the conversation with us. And I'm going to bring another person into the conversation. For a view from the other side of the aisle, we have Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Good to be back.
And why don't you give us your top level reactions?
Well, this is like being in the produce section of 7-Eleven. You're not really sure if any of it is safe.
It's not.
It doesn't seem like these people are preparing for the debate to come. I think we're going to have this big cultural war a year from now. It's going to be really ugly. And very little of this seems to have anything to do with preparing for that. And I heard a lot of proposals where I don't think there's majority support. I think the majority of the country wants to get back to normal, wants to stop hiding their children from the television screens. I think that's the mandate here. And fighting over whose health care plan, I think this has nothing to do with what was actually going to happen.
All right, but I want to ask, I'm not confident that in the general election debates against Donald Trump, we're going to be able to stop hiding our children from the television screens. Is it going to get really better then?
No, it will be worse. And I was hoping that somebody would be able to address what's coming, that maybe the Democrats would find some Abraham Lincoln character who would be able to win the war and then somehow heal the country. But I haven't seen it, but I have to recognize that this early that you don't see who's going to look great a year from now. So I have to restrain myself. But I found the healthcare debate very, very disappointing. I found it, like, Eva, I agree with Kamala Harris that it was very, what kind of a headache. So I really didn't like what I saw at all.
All right. Actually, Michael, go ahead.
So I typically agree with him on some things. but I will say the healthcare debate was a robust debate. It was about access.
It was long.
It was a strong beginning of the debate. And I thought there were some standouts. I thought we litigated Medicare for all and the understanding that millions of Americans, even under the Affordable Care Act, will not have health insurance. And if we have the values that we want everyone to have access to coverage, keeping them out of the ER and out of inpatient days, which are more costly, let's debate how do you open the tent to get more people coverage. That was healthy. I actually like substance. I think oftentimes, particularly with this president, we will not get substance. Democrats brought substance last night. I think that's empowering, and I think that's encouraging going into this election cycle.
Let's take a couple of calls. Travis from Route 28. How's it? Let's try that again. Travis, Route 128. You're in the conversation. What's on your mind?
I'm not sure whether what I'm hearing is from people who actually watched the debate last night. I haven't heard the name Bernie Sanders mentioned once.
Now, so, Travis, did you watch and you felt Bernie Sanders was a strong performer?
Yes. But more importantly, his ideas predominate. His ideas are the only ideas that make any sense. And what your panel is doing is behaving exactly like the rest of the media, the Boston Globe this morning, et cetera. Bernie Sanders is a no-show. He doesn't exist. He has been completely marginalized, and I frankly find it absurd.
All right. So, Travis, I'm going to add one more voice to yours, Emily from Westford, who I think also wants to talk about Sanders. Go ahead, Emily.
Hi. I actually thought that I heard a lot of substance last night, particularly from Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, and also Yang really shined for me last night. And the only real loser in my mind was actually Biden, who just didn't really give a lot of strong ideas, to contradict the bold progressive ideas that they put forward.
All right, Emily, thanks. So we have two callers, Susan, who say, wait a minute, Bernie has shaped this discussion. He was there. He was strong. What about him?
Well, I think that because we've seen Bernie for 4 years and we've heard his issues and his ideas, I think that's part of how you get lost in it a little bit, because there's nothing new there that people see. Not to take away his ideas or his thinking, but when you're watching something for the first time, many of the people are new to the stage. You haven't heard them speak before. And so you're looking for that newness, much the way that last caller said, Yang was interesting to me, because she hadn't seen Yang before. I don't think we hadn't seen Warren, who, you know, was taking up Bernie's mantle in many ways, Warren and Biden next to each other. So I think it's the curiosity of those who are following these races that maybe draws you to some of the other candidates. And Bernie's not, what he's saying is not new to us.
So, Ed, Michael.
I just want to apologize to your caller, because I think Bernie did a great job last night.
Yeah, it's not.
I think the issue for Bernie is, and for me, is it's like a parent who yells at you a lot. Yeah. And after some point, it just becomes yelling.
Yeah.
Is people have gotten used to Bernie with that passion, and it doesn't adjust, right? It's not new, to your point. So I think, you know, to your caller's credit, I think he's spot on with pushing us on healthcare, with education, with the criminal justice. I know his team. You know, I've become very good friends with members of his team. They're exciting young people that are working for him. So, you know, my apology to the caller. Bernie Sanders was definitely there last night and was a strong contributor to that debate.
So we have a couple of other callers on the lines who want to talk about Bernie Sanders, but I'm going to move us now into some of the issues. I feel like we've done a good job looking at who was on the stage and kind of how they showed up. I want to come back to healthcare, Michael Curry, for a minute, because you talked about, you know, this was a really substantive debate. Ed, it doesn't sound like you thought it was a winning debate for the Dems. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, they're just talking to themselves about this, that you know, who's going to outlaw private insurance, and does your plan cover 5 million more people than my plan? That seems irrelevant. I have no belief that the general election will have anything to do with those things. I think it's fine to briefly express a desire to get more coverage, to fix the inequities of the system. To say that everybody doesn't like their health insurance is really inaccurate. I really disagree with Senator Warren on all that. I think that what they're talking about is not really where the American public is at, although I do think their frustration with healthcare is pretty big.
So here's Kamala Harris saying the debate isn't between us about healthcare. The debate is between the Democrats and President Trump.
Frankly, I think this discussion has given the American public a headache. What they want to know is that they're going to have health care and cost will not be a barrier to getting it. But let's focus on the end goal. If we don't get Donald Trump out of office, he's going to get rid of all of it.
So, Susan, I don't want to say it's internecine, because there's a pretty big difference between let's do more Obamacare and let's go Medicare for all. These are not small distinctions. But is it a winning strategy for Democrats to fight inside about how much we rehaul health care when most people just want health care and just want to beat President Trump?
You know, I think we've seen in every poll that the largest factor for who people are going to choose, for whom they're going to vote, is who can beat Trump. So I do think that that is the overriding issue in the Democratic primary. I just do. And I, you know, agree a little bit that, you know, Michael, I hear you in terms of having a conversation. I don't know how in-depth one can get in a stage of 10 people with, you know, 60-second answers. You know, if you want depth, you go to their websites and you read their policy papers. I don't think that forum of a debate is really where you're looking for depth. You're looking for some idea of whether people are moderates or liberals and which lane they're in, as they say. And you're looking for, who do I like? Who do I feel good about? And who do I think can beat Donald Trump? So I think you have to go back and say, what are people really trying to get out of this debate?
All right. In a minute, I'm going to go to a break. But before I do, the lines are full. So I'd like to get a few caller voices in before we go to break. Mary from Andover, join the conversation.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm curious, given how much time was spent discussing health care last night, why women's health care in particular and the number of states that have been rolling back access to it, that never came up, not once.
Michael, you're nodding.
I think it's an oversight. I think if you talk about Title 10 and the attack on Title 10 by this Trump administration, it was an oversight for the Democratic Party not to go there. So she's right. I think, you know, a robust conversation about public charge. I do believe you can't get too deep into substance in a debate, but you can give people bite sizes. Mm-hmm. I think, as I heard the figure, 10 million people uninsured or underinsured, You might not remember everything about a healthcare conversation, but you remember that number. So I think that there was an excellent job last night. They did miss some critical points. Title 10 is one of those.
All right, one more call. Michael, you're on 93 North. Join the conversation.
Hi, I'm a young college student, and I have not met a single person in my age demographic who supports Biden. And I think one thing that was very apparent last night was the lack of discussion about climate change. And I think the pulse of the young people in this nation is very much leaning towards Sanders and people who are active on their stance on climate change. And I'm just curious as to you guys' thoughts on what younger people in this nation are feeling and thinking.
All right, so I'm going to give our guests a chance to think about that while we take a quick break. Susan, Ed, Michael, stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and we will come back and talk more presidential debate. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are going to jump right back into our analysis of last night's Democratic presidential primary debate in Houston. Here with us in Studio 3 is an expert panel. Susan Tracy is a Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group. Susan, thanks for being here.
Sure.
Michael Curry is the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, thanks for joining us as well.
Good to be back.
All right. So, Michael and Susan, before the break, we had a caller who said, where are the young people's issues, especially climate change? So, Susan, what about it?
One, the caller's right. I mean, climate change, I think, is a critical issue, and it's certainly going to be one that, you know, young people are going to gravitate around. And I don't think we're going to have a Democratic nominee who doesn't have some kind of a thoughtful plan around climate change. So 100% agreement. You know, I would go back to something I said earlier. You know, I think that it's hard to get to every issue on a debate stage with 10 people and four reporters asking questions. You know, even though it was a long debate, I think that there are always going to be things. We didn't talk about the economy at all last night. There was no discussion on the economy.
Especially not jobs, college savings,
nothing,
that kind of thing.
Nothing. Yeah. So I think there were a lot of issues that were should have been on the table that weren't. And I think we have some time to get to those issues. They're big, they matter, and I agree with the caller.
So, Ed, there were a lot of calls before the break. Hey, you're focusing on the wrong things, the wrong people. I'm not hearing about young people's issues, et cetera. Did the debate focus on the right things last night to beat Donald Trump in the general election?
No, it focused on a lot of things that could happen if one of these people won and had 65 senators in place. I think that there's no reason to believe any of these things will happen. There's no mandate for the Green New Deal. There's no mandate for overhauling the entire healthcare system or taking everybody's guns away. There's no consensus for any of those things. So I want to see people are going to look at Donald Trump and his competitor and say, who's going to provide a framework for security and prosperity for me in general and judge them on their character and what they can expect in the future, probably during a not-so-awesome economy. I don't think that if the economy tanks, we're going to do the Green New Deal. That's ridiculous. So I think it's time if the Democrats want to take over the White House, they have to be able to articulate how they would actually govern. And govern is not about policy papers. It is about a lot of other things.
Michael.
Yeah, I think we have to be aspirational, right? We talk about the Green New Deal. There's the war on poverty. We can't over-focus on Donald Trump. We have to focus on the fact that there are issues that we should be aspirational about. Gun control, education. And I think the Democratic Party and the leading candidates are pitching and proposing things that will make the public think and generate ideas. And maybe we shift public awareness and interest in a way that they then say, you know what, maybe we can do something about climate control. But we should not play to Donald Trump. I think we're remiss. We're at fault if we're over-focusing on him and lowering the bar just to win.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to be part of the conversation. Maria from Lawrence, please go ahead.
The major issue in the United States is that there's not a clear perception about the degree of depravity with respect to the medical delivery system. We're a family with three generations of doctors, and the age of death is increasingly younger. The incidence of cancer is ever rising. The capacity of the American population to understand the situation is extremely limited, and Bernie Sanders is quite brilliant. One of the difficulties is just that. It is brilliant and not understood.
All right.
One of the
I appreciate that, Maria. I do. And I think you've given us a good recap to our healthcare debate. You know, I want to move on from Bernie Sanders and dive into some more of the issues. One of the issues that it does seem like we're struggling with as a country is this question of gun control. It's come up a couple of times in this discussion. It was one of those moments also that I wonder if Dems pitted themselves against Republicans in a pretty powerful way. Let's listen to Beto O'Rourke. This was clearly one of the big moments of the night last night.
And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
Okay, so there are a couple things I want to talk about in that, and I basically have a question for each of you on this. So, Susan, to start, there was a lot of fire and passion in that. Do the Democrats need to have more of that fire and passion at this stage to keep voters engaged and to distinguish themselves?
I think Beto has added a new debate question for the future, which is, should we be taking away, military-style weapons from people? So I think that exchange last night invited a new conversation at the highest level, and you'll probably see it in congressional and Senate races as well. I admired him for that. You know, he was obviously, you know, it was in his town that the last of many shootings took place. So I understand his fire and his passion. And quite frankly, I think, you know, when you read numbers like 90% of the public wants background checks, wants something to happen, I just think that the time is ripe for this conversation and for this level of passion.
So, Michael Curry, to that point, here's Amy Klobuchar saying, hey, the Dems have done this. This is Mitch McConnell's fault that we haven't gotten further along.
What unites us is that right now on Mitch McConnell's desk are three bills: universal background checks, closing the Charleston loophole, and passing my bill to make sure that domestic abusers don't get AK-47.
So even when the Democrats are leading on this, the laws aren't getting passed. Does that piece of it need to be in the gun control conversation?
It does. The Senate is holding up legislation. And quite frankly, the NRA is controlling this conversation. They are putting the money that is preventing this from moving forward. It's courage. And after Columbine, after Newtown, if we can't get there, something is really wrong with us as a people. And I don't attribute that just to Republicans or to Mitch McConnell. We as a country, if we cannot get there when we have kids dying and people dying in malls and on street corners every day in this country, shame on all of us for not holding Mitch, the Senate, and the entire Congress accountable for that.
So Ed, Michael talked about the NRA at the beginning of that comment. I did wonder when Beto O'Rourke says, you know, hell yes, we're going to take your guns, is he handing an effective attack ad to the opposition? Because the NRA has been saying, hey, the Democrats want to take your guns.
Go type into Google right now. It's already working. This is madness. There's no mandate to take away this kind of weapon. The Armalite rifles, there's so many kinds of them. It isn't even a gun. It's a platform. There are extraordinary number that we're not going to take them away. And for the Democrats to say to some guy, you're going to choose between your rifle and a Democrat is absolutely the wrong decision right now. I can't believe Bill Clinton once decided to calm down about gun control because he was just losing people who he needed for other things. There is public support for Massachusetts-style gun laws, registration, references, a bunch of little things. That's what the support is. This I'm going to take your gun away is just powering the conservative to say, yep, we got to stick with Trump because I don't want to choose between my gun and Kamala Harris. It's just insanity.
All right, so we've got 1 minute left. So we're going to do a rapid fire, and I'm just going to ask you, there's another debate next month. What should the big focus be in the next one? Susan.
Oh, that's a tough one right off the bat. But I do
surprise.
Think, yeah, surprise. I do think that I'd like to see a different style of debate. I think this kind of throwing questions at people, I'm kind of sick of it. I'd like to see some format changes where we could get candidates to start talking to one another and maybe get a little bit more of a dynamic. So less about an issue for me, more about format.
Okay, Ed Lyons.
I'd like to hear more about character. I'd like to hear about management. I'd like to hear about the things about actually being president. They could ask President Obama to talk about his experiences in actually being president, something like that. I'd like to hear a more realistic assessment of what the job actually is, which is not putting out proposals that are never going to pass.
Okay, Michael, in a few words.
Yeah, I agree. Format change. And I'd like the next debate to be focused on what the damage that Donald Trump has done, not only with our Supreme Court and the placements on the court, but within the administrations under his authority. there is a lot we're losing there, and they need to debate that, discuss that, and present an alternative plan.
Okay, that's Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP board. Michael, thanks.
Thank you.
Also with us is Susan Tracy, Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group. Susan, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. We're produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. I hope you'll join us again next week for more Radio Boston.